All lines are now bridged.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you for joining today's HITECH meeting. I appreciate you taking the time today. I would like to thank the members of the public for joining today, and I hope everyone is well. We do have a full agenda today, so I will officially open us up, starting with roll call. Carolyn Peterson.
Good morning.
Robert Waugh. I knew he's on the phone. Michael Adcock. Thought I heard him dial in as well. Christina Carabello.
Lauren, this is Robert. I was on mute. Sorry.
That's okay. Hi, Robert. Michael Adcock.
Good morning. Christina's here.
Good morning, Christina. All right, we'll circle back to Michael. Tina Esposito. Cynthia Fisher?
Yes, this is Cynthia.
Valerie Gray? Okay, Anil Jain?
Good morning.
Good morning. Jim Gerges?
Here.
John Kansky?
I'm here.
Ken Kawamoto?
Good morning.
Stephen Lane?
Good morning.
Les Winner.
Good morning.
Arian Malik. Not yet. Okay. Clint McDonald. Not yet. Aaron Meary.
Good morning.
Fred Oliver.
Good morning.
Terry O'Malley.
Good morning.
James Santella.
I'm here.
Raj Ratwani.
Good morning.
Morning, Steve Reedy. Not yet. Okay, Abby Sears.
Here.
Alexis Snyder.
Good morning.
Tasha Turma.
Good morning.
Andy Truscott. Not yet. Okay, Cheryl Turney. Denise Webb.
Good morning.
Good morning. Michelle Schreiber.
Good morning.
Good morning. James Elsey.
Good morning.
Good morning. Ram Sriram.
Good morning.
Good morning. Addie Gundalapi. Jonathan Eberger. Okay. And I do believe Amy Abernathy will be absent today. From the ONC leadership side, we have Dr. Rucker, Steve Posnack, Elise Sweeney-Anthony, Avinash Shandog, Ryan Argentari, Elizabeth Myers, Michael Lipinski, Rob Anthony, and we have Denise St. Clair joining us today from CMS. Are there any other HITECH members that I missed during the roll call?
Yes, this is Clem McDonald.
Good morning, Clem.
Thank you.
Anyone else? Okay. Just as a reminder for those that are not on the Adobe session, I realize there may be some technical challenges here of late. So please just chime in on the phone, and we'll make sure to get you in the queue. At this point, I will turn it over to our national coordinator, Dr. Rucker.
Thanks, Lauren. Well, first of all, welcome, everybody. Obviously, these are, as we all know, unique times. I think from an ONC point of view, the sort of the pandemic, I think, really points out the importance of the work we've been doing and, you know, will be doing in the future with interoperability and making, you know, modern technology, enabling things like care at a distance. All of these things, I think every one of us has a renewed appreciation for the importance of it. I personally want to thank, on behalf of all of ONC, everyone who on HITECH and frankly the public listening for the extraordinary comments that helped us in formulating the rules, certainly the ONC rule to be a what we think is a good balance of the various interests of the public in getting access to their information, of providers reducing burden on them with some of the API tools that will get out of, you know, grow out of the rule. We've obviously talked about some of the things where APIs can help with prior authorization and rethinking the entire business of quality measures and billing documentation. So the rule sets, I think, those advances, those causes. We obviously want a vibrant EHR vendor community with innovation, both from the current EHR vendors and folks who might enter the app economy. So we think we've done a good balance there, but obviously that is for you to judge. But I want to thank folks for all of their contributions. As you look at the length of the rule, you will see that of the 1,200 odd pages, probably 1,100 of them roughly are our, you know, comments, responses, and interaction to the feedback you gave us and those discussions. So hopefully the thinking there that you've incorporated, that you provided, is adequately incorporated. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Steve Posnick, our Deputy National Coordinator.
All right. Thanks, Don. Thanks, everybody. Certainly, as we mentioned, always, thank you very much for your time in attending the HITECH meetings. Certainly, with the backdrop of current events, your time is as valuable as possible today. And we want to make sure that we cover all the updates for you in kind of keeping with our mission and activities. We're going to cover the final rule that was released. Our CMS colleague will also give you an update on that, and that'll be the largest part of the agenda today. Obviously, in a virtual meeting, we want to make sure that we make the most effective use of everyone's time and keep you doing all the valiant healthcare things that you're doing for the country. So thanks very much again. Thank you to all the healthcare workers out there fighting on our behalf, and I'll turn it over to I guess Robert and Carolyn for the review of the agenda in minutes.
Well, thank you, Steve, and thank you, Don. This is Robert. We also, as chairs, would like to welcome you all to our meeting, and again, appreciate everybody taking their time and talent to contribute to this effort. I think you've already heard the theme of the day is the final rule. As we all recall, we spent a great deal of time providing comments in the proposed rulemaking process. I think Don talked about several hundred pages here. I think we contributed a couple hundred pages of comments to that process. So I think it'll be a good discussion to see the details of the final rule and have a chance to discuss it as a group. And so that's our plan today. As you know, we'll remind you also we had to move our April meeting to a virtual meeting, so we'll get more details about that at the end of this meeting. So with that, I'll turn it over to Carolyn.
Thanks, Robert. Good morning, everyone, and thanks for making time in this very busy and chaotic time to attend the meeting today. We have some really good presentations, and I think it will be very enlightening as we think about how to go forward with the final rule and the remainder of our work for the year. With that, I have one announcement that we have transmitted the annual report on, so our work in terms of the fiscal year 19 annual report is done, and the work group will be starting up later in May with the fiscal year 20 version. Now let's review the agenda. We have an overview of the CMS interoperability and patient access final rule, followed by an overview of the ONC 21st Century Cures Act final rule and the 2015 edition Cures updates. We have the ONC 21st Century Cures Act Final Rule Conditions of Certification provisions. We'll take a break, and then we'll return to a review of the ONC 21st Century Cures Act Final Rule Information Blocking provisions, followed by the Health IT for the Care Continuum provisions. We'll have a public comment period, and then closing remarks and adjourn. With that, we now need to approve the minutes from the February 19 meeting. All those in favor of approving the minutes, please signify by saying aye.
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 All those who do not choose to approve the minutes, please signify by saying nay. And are there any abstentions? Thank you. It looks like we have approved the minutes from the meeting of February 19. And I will hand the mic back to Robert for any other comments or business before we get into the overview of the CMS interoperability and patient access final rule.
Thank you, Carolyn. And just I think we all should thank our chairs, Carolyn and Aaron, on getting the annual report done and transmitted and on to the next annual report. No rest for the weary, but we appreciate all the work that that work group did to get that annual report completed. And as Carolyn has noted, it's been transmitted to the national coordinator at this point. So without any further ado, let's move on to the overview of the CMS interoperability and patient access final rule. And I think the person taking through us will be Beth and, oh no, I'm sorry, Denise St. Clair will lead that discussion.
Hello everyone, this is Denise St. Clair. Thank you so much for the opportunity to give you a quick high-level overview of the CMS interoperability and patient access final rule. We can go to the next slide. Ultimately, our goal with the interoperability and patient access final rule was to get to one step closer to our ideal state for interoperability in our healthcare system. And that is a system where we have interoperable healthcare data exchange that will enable coordinated care, improve health outcomes, and reduce costs, improve the experience for patients, provide additional tools for providers to be able to, with less burden, do their best work, and to ensure payers are able to facilitate efficient and coordinated care. So the goal is to get to our ideal state, and this is just the first step. Next slide. And ultimately, everything we're doing really falls into this vision of our roadmap, which is essentially built on a strong foundation of privacy and security, working through sort of three main buckets of work. One is patient access, empowering patients, making sure they have the information they need, when they need it, where they need it, safe and secure, and in a way that they can truly understand and make the best use of it. And so that's really a big focus of what we were looking to do in this role and start down this path. We're also looking to connect healthcare through data exchange. So we want to support the value-based care system, and that means we need seamless data exchange across the care continuum. And so that's the next big piece of the puzzle. And finally, technology and standards, and that's obviously working with our partners at ONC and making sure that we're promoting the use and of the latest and greatest technology and standards, that we're getting the data out there and helping drive innovation by providing fuel for what we are looking toward with a very vibrant app community. And there's obviously a lot of incredibly smart people out there who can do a lot with this information and making sure it's available in a safe and secure way for everyone's benefit. So this is the overall vision. This is what we were thinking about as we started down the path of the interoperability and patient access rule process. We got a lot of feedback and we are always looking for more. And I think the most important piece for us is really stating that this is just the first step in our current journey. And there's obviously a lot of foundation that has been laid and a lot of work previous to this, and we know there's a lot of work ahead. And so we're looking forward to that, and we're excited about the opportunities that we have now, and especially in this moment in time when we are in such a unique situation, appreciating that this kind of work, as Dr. Rucker was saying, can really take us to a better place and ensure patients have what they need, providers have what they need, and we can support our system together. So that's the foundation that we worked with. And then what did we actually finalize? Next slide. This is a one-stop shop of the final policies in the CMS interoperability and patient access final rule. And I'll just take you through from the timeline perspective, starting at the front here with the first policies that will be applicable. And the first things that will kick in will be the hospital event notifications, the patient event notifications. So 6 months after the publication of the final rule in the Federal Register, and obviously we both released, ONC and CMS released our rules on our respective websites last week. It feels much more than a week ago. But they have not yet been, at least I haven't checked, published in the Federal Register. So once it's published in the Federal Register, the clock starts, and 6 months after that, hospitals will be required to send patient event notifications regarding admission, discharge, and transfer. And this obviously will greatly support care coordination and ensure that patients can get that timely follow-up when their care team is aware of an event in the hospital. And so that's the first thing that will come online. In late 2020, we have a couple of public reporting policies that will be applicable. So we have one related to information blocking for eligible clinicians and hospitals who are taking part in the Promoting Interoperability Program. If they do not attest to certain attestations that indicate or attest in such a way that indicate that they may be information blocking, then their names will be publicly reported on CMS websites. So that's just one way to further show our belief that information blocking is not something that will support our system. And this is one lever we have to be able to shed a light on that and help patients get some view into that piece. The other public reporting policy is related to digital contact information. So MPES includes a optional field where providers can put their digital contact information. And that's been there for a little bit of time now. And what we finalized in the rule is that providers who do not enter digital contact information into that field will also have their names publicly reported. And this is, again, to encourage all providers to get that information out there. We really want the seamless data exchange to happen. And one key piece of that puzzle is making sure people know how to contact each other in a secure digital manner. So, for instance, direct address is one thing that providers can include so that other providers can find them for care coordination purposes. And we do hope as we move down the path of application programming interfaces that providers will also include their digital endpoints there, and those that have them can do that now. So multiple pieces of digital contact information can be included in MPES. So both of those public reporting pieces will be made public at the end of the year. Now we get into the application programming interface, the API policies that may be of more interest to folks on the line. And two API policies that we finalized in the rule are both applicable starting January 1, 2021. The first is the patient access API. And in this rule, we are requiring the health plans that CMS regulates, specifically Medicare Advantage, Medicaid and CHIP fee-for-service, Medicaid and CHIP managed care, and qualified health plans on the individual federally facilitated exchanges. These payers are required starting January 1, 2021 to implement, test, and monitor a standards-based API that is accessible to third-party applications and developers. So So this is a FHIR R4 API, and it will need to meet the interoperability technical standards that were finalized by HHS in the ONC 21st Century Cures Act rule, which you'll hear a lot more about this morning. And what this API must include at a minimum is adjudicated claims, including costs, encounters with capitated providers, provider remittances, enrollee cost sharing, and clinical data in the form of the USCDI version 1 if it's maintained by the payer. And again, you'll hear more about that from our ONC team and partners who are on the line who can speak to it much more eloquently than I. So payers will make this set of claims and clinical data available through the API for Medicare Advantage Part D plans. They must also make prescription drug claims available and formulary information, and Medicaid and CHIP, fee-for-service and managed care plans, must make preferred drug lists available through the Patient Access API. And all this data will be available so that if a patient finds an app that they like and they want to use it and they authorize that app to ping their payer to access this data, the patients will be able to get a hold of that data in a way that is most useful and valuable to them that they can really understand. And we've seen already through Blue Button 2.0 some of the super innovative and valuable apps that the community has put together using claims data. So we're excited to see what the community will come up with both the claims and the this limited set of clinical data to start. Obviously, privacy and security are a huge piece of this puzzle, something top of mind at all times as we're working through these policies. And there's one thing that we did add in the final rule as an option based on the comments that we received and the wonderful feedback that we've gotten from the stakeholder community. And in addition to something that we proposed and we're finalizing, which is requiring payers to make educational materials available to patients to help them make the best, most informed choices about which third-party apps to think about, what kinds of things to consider when choosing an app to keep their data as safe and secure as possible. We also are allowing payers, or providing the option for payers, to ask third-party app developers to attest to having certain privacy provisions in place, and they can then inform patients about that attestation, and patients could choose to think twice about sharing their data with an app that perhaps doesn't meet certain privacy provisions. So one, making sure that there's a very easy to read, easy to understand, comprehensive privacy policy available for the patient, and they really do understand how their data will be used. What are the secondary uses of data? What are the other data elements on the enrollee's phone? If they have an app on their phone, that might be accessed by the app. Will it be geolocation? Is there anything else? So just making sure patients are aware of what their options are, who they're sending their data to, and how best to make that best, most informed decision. So that's something that you'll see in the final rule. And the data that will be shared, so starting January 1, 2021, the APIs are available. The payers need to make available through the API any data that meet the minimum set required with the date of service of January 1, 2016 forward. So we ultimately need to start somewhere, but appreciate that there is burden associated with preparing data for sharing via the FHIR-based API. So that initial set of data is 2016 forward. The second API policy that we are finalizing is the Provider Directory API, and this is a public-facing API. And here, we are requiring that payers make certain information about their provider networks available via a public-facing digital API that will be available through a public-facing digital endpoint on their payer's website. And this is so that the API is easily accessible to third-party applications. Provider directory information is obviously not PHI and publicly available. So although the API needs to meet the interoperability technical standards, again, finalized by HHS in the ONC 21st Century Cures Act rule, it wouldn't include the security protocols related to things like authentication and authorization because we're talking about publicly accessible data. But no later than 30 calendar days after an update is received or new information is received by a payer, they'll need to make that provider directory information available via the API. And at a minimum, this would include provider name, address, phone number, and specialties. And this applies to the payers that we regulate. Again, Medicare Advantage, Medicaid fee-for-service, and managed care, CHIP fee-for-service and managed care. It does not apply to qualified health plans on the federally facilitated exchanges because QHP issuers are already required to make information like this available in a specific machine-readable format. MAPD plans will also include pharmacy directory information through the API, and all of this will be available starting January 1, 2021. And again, this makes these data available across plans, across players, for innovative app developers to really help patients negotiate and understand what their options are. This is just the first step in provider directory work that we are doing. We appreciate that there's a good deal to do around some things like accuracy of the data and timeliness of the data. And so these are top of mind for next steps on provider directory work, but this is at least a first step on getting the data out there and helping patients negotiate these data in the most valuable ways for them. Our next policy is applicable January 1, 2022, and that's the payer-to-payer data exchange. This policy requires all the payers to regulate to have a system in place to exchange data, particularly the USCDI clinical data, which they have or which they maintain, and incorporate those data into the patient's record. So if a current patient wants their previous payer to send data to their current payer, they can request that up to 5 years after disenrollment, request their payer to send those data forward, and then the payer would receive and incorporate those data into their record. We didn't specify a standard or method of doing this in this rule. In this rule, we provide the opportunity for the payer to choose. We know many payers work with AHIEs. There's also obviously the option to use an API, which we strongly encourage. And ultimately, the goal of this policy is helping the patient create their cumulative health record with their current payer. The ability to, over time, have all of your data in one place so that you can carry it with you throughout the healthcare system from payer to payer and provider to provider. And again, this is applicable January 1, 2022. Finally, we have a policy in place to improve the dual eligible experience. Right now, states are exchanging on a monthly basis buy-in data and MMA file data with CMS, and that will become required to happen daily. So moving from monthly to daily for the data exchange to really help support patients getting the right services at the right time and avoiding some of the duplication that will have to happen if that dual eligible status, for instance, is not immediately known, that can lead to additional rework and paperwork and even sometimes for patients not getting access to the services that they should have access to as quickly as they should have them. So that will significantly improve the experience for patients. So that is, in a very high-level nutshell, the policies that we finalized in the rule. And if you go to the next slide, we've provided a lot of information for folks on this website. So information to help payers as well as app developers in developing the APIs and the apps. There's links to the implementation guides, reference implementation sample data that can be used as stakeholders work to implement the policies. There's also some supporting documents, so for instance, best practices for payers and app developers as they're working to develop these technologies, and particularly for app developers around privacy policies and some of the wonderful resources out there that they can use to really create those true patient-friendly resources. And also there's some information for payers who are required to put that education material together for their patients. There's some content that they can pull from to put those education materials together so everyone doesn't have to sort of reinvent the wheel, but there's some base information they can start with and then tailor to their patient populations. So the rule is also on this site if you haven't found it yet. So strongly encourage folks to let us know if you have questions to review this, and we are excited for the next steps on the road to interoperability. Thank you, Lauren. If there's questions, we're happy to take them.
Great. Yes, thank you. We do have a few minutes for any questions or comments for Denise.
Let's start with Sasha Termat.
Thanks. Hi, Denise. Thanks for overviewing some of the initiatives in CMS's rule. I had a question about the alignment on the US CDI standard for clinical data. I think it's great to see the use of the same standards and technical formats with FHIR in those two areas, but I was surprised to see the difference in timelines between ONC's regulation and CMS's regulation. And I'm concerned that the CMS timeline for adopting the newer version of FHIR and the additional resources that are part of USCDI could place a burden on those participants. Do you have any, I guess, background on why the timelines are not aligned between the two programs?
So essentially, with use of the USCDI in the CMS rule, we're obviously looking at the payer population and it's data that the payers already maintain. And the resources that are needed in terms of the FHIR resources to be able to share these data via an FHIR R4 API are currently available in terms of, say, one of the links on the site is for the US Core IG. And so that provides the tools that folks will need to be able to prepare the data and share the data in R4 for the purposes of implementing this API. So we appreciate that from the ONC side of the house, that the implementation of USCDI within the EHR certification and making sure that certified EHR are ready to share those data is a year later, essentially, than the CMS regulation. But given the fact that we've got payers who are implementing these APIs on the CMS side, we can still make sure we're aligned in terms of the data elements, aligned in terms of mapping those data for FHIR and preparing them for sharing. And appreciate that the certified EHR requirements will come later, but we do still think that there's the tools needed for the payers to be able to implement this by January 1, 2021.
Okay, let's go to Valerie Gray.
Hi, Denise. Thank you for this overview. It's very helpful. I was a little disappointed when I saw that the final rule excluded a requirement for health plans to connect to, I think, what was called trusted networks, trusted exchange networks. Could you talk a little bit about why that was removed in the final rule for me?
Sure. We received a good number of comments on this, and ultimately what our commenters told us was they wanted to see a mature TEFCA in place to be able to facilitate that trusted exchange network. So all of the brilliant work that's being done on TEFCA, and that is obviously ongoing, they wanted that to work through prior to us requiring the payers to be on a trusted exchange network. The criteria that were proposed, they felt, could be best accommodated by TEFCA, and they were afraid there would be too few trusted exchange networks that currently met the criteria in the current landscape, and just felt it was just essentially too soon to require it. And so it's definitely something folks are incredibly interested in, but just felt we weren't there yet, and we didn't want to get ahead of the work that's being done on TEFCA. So that was really the decision point there.
Hey, thanks. Can we go to Jim Gerges now?
Yeah, hey, thank you. And pardon me if you're going to get to this, but, you know, we were keenly reading the timelines because there's work to be done by providers and technology companies to adhere to both the CMS but also the ONC timelines. With the national emergency of the pandemic, is there consideration on adjusting timelines compassionately so that we don't inadvertently pull people off of important pandemic work? Is that being contemplated?
Of course, we're in a very, very, very unique situation, and we are definitely thinking through all of the real and incredibly important work that everyone needs to be focusing on right now. So that is definitely something that's under consideration. Everything is very new, and so we're assessing the situation and looking for feedback, and we'll definitely, I'm sure, have more to say. But right now it's being assessed. That's but definitely top of mind, and we appreciate the situation. So thank you.
And do we have any high-tech members on the phone who have questions? Denise Webb?
Yes, thank you. Hello. I have heard mentioned either in presentations or I might have read that CMS, as a result of this final rule, has talked about payers being subject to information blocking. And I was a little confused by that. I admit I have not read the rule, the CMS rule, yet, because I'm deep in the throes of the ONC rule and trying to get through that first. But in the ONC rule, payers are not defined as an actor in information blocking. So I'm just wondering, what sort of enforcement is there going to be with payers? Is CMS applying the ONC rule to payers when it comes to information blocking?
No. As you pointed out, ONC does not list payers as an actor under the information blocking provisions. We, of course, strongly support the information blocking work that ONC has done, and think that the spirit of it is something that throughout the healthcare ecosystem we should all definitely be attuned to, but it is not something that we are applying to payers. The one information blocking provision in the CMS rule is related to the promoting interoperability programs and the eligible clinicians and hospitals who are taking part in those programs. So that's the one specific information blocking piece that we have. In terms of payers making data available to patients, that comes down more to our programmatic authority around making sure patients have timely access to their information and are able to use that information in a way to support their healthcare. And so at the programmatic level of the payers that we regulate, there are already provisions in place to encourage that and to require that access, and this is one way to further encourage that. And of course, it's also, you know, in the spirit of HIPAA in terms of patients' right to get their own data. So in the spirit of that as well. But letter of the law, no. The ONC information blocking rules do not directly apply to the payers.
Thank you.
This is Clem. I don't have the machinery to raise my hand, but I just wonder if you could put me on the list.
Yes, go ahead, Clem.
Well, this COVID-19 thing is really a complicated space. And this morning's New York Times described the teeny trickle of testing results that we have gotten through compared to every other country. And some of it has to do with the regulatory and legal constraints, like CDC tests only records a test of a specimen, doesn't have any information about patients. So there's no way to aggregate those kind of things. And in this time of sort of crisis, wonder if some regulation or some tweaking of our intense concern about individual privacy might be relaxed a bit so that we could find out what's going on and stop people from getting sick. I know it's a touchy subject, but we are really at the extreme end of the of all the countries and the ability to kind of get the testing connected, and let alone getting it done.
Yes, appreciated. Beyond the scope of obviously what I can speak to, but definitely something that we can mention to our leadership as something that was raised for consideration.
Okay, thank you.
Stephen Lane and then Les Leonard.
Hello, thank you. I really appreciated your comments, Denise, regarding the information blocking and the interface between the ONC rules and the CMS promoting interoperability requirements. I know that I've submitted and others have submitted some questions about that, and specifically how that plays out in terms of requirements on providers to release information included in the USCDI. Specifically clinical notes, test results, the timeliness of that release, et cetera. Can you say a little bit more about that interface and how promoting interoperability specifically will help to prevent information blocking?
So I know we have some of our CCSQ colleagues on the line, so definitely let me know if you would like to speak to the promoting interoperability program specifically, but I think that at a high level, Stephen, what we can say is that the intersection of the ONC rule and the promoting interoperability program in terms of the USCDI, the requirements for 2015 CERT essentially will require the USCDI to be what is made available to patients from providers, from the EHRs, when the requirement kicks in, and our ONC colleagues can correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm pretty sure it's 24 months after the publication of the rule in the Federal Register. So it would be at that time that providers would need to be able to share the USCDI data with patients via patient access requirements under the Promoting Interoperability Programs Using Certified EHR Technology. So as was asked earlier, there's that the requirement of the EHRs to have the capability to make those data available versus in the CMS rule, where we're requiring payers who already maintain these data to prepare the data and make them available for sharing via an API following the minimum data set of the US CDI. The data elements in, included in the US CDI is sort of that base minimum data to share. So that is a super high level. If, for more detail, I would defer to our ONC colleagues or any of our CCSQ colleagues who would like to add to that.
So just so I'm clear, you mentioned 24 months that US CDI would be required 24 months after publication. And I guess I was under the impression that, that it was a shorter timeline, that we were looking at 6 months after publication for US CDI and 24 for all electronic health information. So maybe over the course of our discussions today, we can try to clarify that.
Yes, and ONC colleagues, correct me if I misspoke.
No, it is 24 months. We can talk more about it in the next presentation. I'll actually touch on
thanks,
it with the US CDI. Yep.
Okay, let's go to Les Leonard.
Hi, I know I'm off subject again, but I want to reinforce what Clem said about the urgency of looking at our privacy laws and the confusing morass of state and federal privacy regulations that may inhibit the effective flow of clinical information during this outbreak. And that I know we're off subject. I know that this is a distraction that you will take back to your leadership, a parking lot issue, but it is so important that you hear this and bring it back to your leadership that we need to move forward on how to restructure privacy so that the information, there can be frictionless information flow about test results and their clinical meaning across responders, particularly with our move to, you know, new testing strategies and telehealth for screening and drive-through facilities for specimen collection and new laboratories bringing up capacity at an unprecedented rate. We need to have effective flow of the data to stop the outbreak.
Thanks, Lynn. And we'll take one last question from Cynthia Fisher.
Thank you. Yes, I'm on the Clem and Les theme in light of this coronavirus. I think as Dr. Rucker kicked us off, is that it's even more imperative that we move faster and how important these rules, and I congratulate ONC and CMS for this Herculean effort to have these rules come about. And I guess, you know, what I would like to pose to our working group is due to the seriousness of this war against the biologic coronavirus, is there a way that this group can come together as we've been working so closely with ONC and CMS over the course of time? Is there a way that we and whomever else on resources that are needed could look at delivering much faster than the 24 months for all electronic health information? And I guess I would say to Clem and Les's points, not just testing, but I think we need to look at, we are in an incredible shape shift of how healthcare will be delivered. And so just taking care of chronic disease and people in their homes in this new level of remote care, and bringing on, you know, national access for physicians to be able to do telemedicine and care anywhere. It behooves us to say, can we come together as a task force and do better? So can we do better than 24 months? What can we deliver as an industry without the mandates of 24 months or 6 months? What can we deliver as an industry? And can we come together to look to deploy the ability of let these pipes open and flow sooner with standards sooner. And so I would volunteer my time on such a task force to do so. And I just want to beg the question, what can we do as citizens to deliver on this sooner?
Yeah, and this is Elise Anthony. I just want to just clarify one of the points that was mentioned a little bit earlier, at least on the OMC side. It's after six months after the effective date of the rule is when some information would be required. And it would be the type of data that's included that's in the USCDI. So not the USCDI standards itself, but the type of data that's covered by the USCDI. And then after 24 months, it would be the full EHI. We will discuss this more as we go through the information blocking section. But just to be clear, so 6 months after the publication date is when you would be required to move some information. And that information would be the type of data in the USCDI. And then you move over after 24 months to the full spectrum of what we define as the EHI. But again, Mike will go over this a little bit further later.
Hey, thanks, Elise. And
no problem.
Cynthia, Clem, and Les. I think we do have plenty of ground on which to base future discussions and further deliberations. But at this point, since we're running about 15 minutes behind, I'm going to ask that we start the next presentation and perhaps loop back on this during the public comment period if we have some time then.
Sorry, I apologize. This is Arianne. Do we have time on the agenda to discuss the COVID-19 response and the role of HIT in COVID-19 response?
We don't have any time built in at this point, but there is the space for closing remarks at the end and the public comment period as well.
Yeah, I would like to, and maybe you can consider during a break, a way to restructure the agenda. I think there are some urgent topics relating to the use of HIT, of information discovery, of disease surveillance, and just given where we are, I understand we just dropped a rule, but given where we are as a nation, I would encourage us to think about putting some time on the agenda to discuss this or perhaps put together a special committee meeting to address the role of health information technology in the COVID-19 response. Thank you.
Okay. Robert and I will touch base with ONC during the break and see what we can come up with. And now let's move to the next presentation, the review of the interoperability, information blocking, and ONC Health IT certification role.
Okay, thank you, Carolyn. This is Elise. How are you? How's everyone doing? I know as everyone who has spoken today has said, there's a lot going on. So we're in the world today. So we are definitely thankful for everyone on this call. We understand how tight time commitments are right now. And, you know, just given the nature of the committee, all that you're doing within the community, to the world community, to support COVID-19 response. So I just want to take a minute and thank folks for that. I also, as Carolyn noted, we are a little bit behind. So I'm going to shorten and or go a little bit faster on my end, because what we've set up today is a series of ONC team members who will talk about different sections of the rule. So we can maybe cut my section a little bit short in terms of the questions, if that's okay with folks, and then the questions that you probably have fit into either the conditions of certification, the information blocking section, or the care continuum. If there are other questions not related to those areas, I'm happy to answer those now, but just in recognition of Carolyn's point that we're running a little bit behind. All right, so next slide. So just a couple of things to mention. You know, while we make every effort to make sure that the presentations are accurate, we do want to note it's not a legal document. So as many of you have already mentioned on the line, you are reading the rule, which is great, because that is the document that we do want folks to refer to. On our website, we have a number of different materials. Please do check that out, healthit.gov/cures-rule. Not only do we have our upcoming webinar dates, the next one will actually be tomorrow at 2 p.m., but we also have a number of fact sheets and other resources that we think would be helpful. Also, for the public that's listening, there's also a complaint process that is attached to the information blocking section and an overall feedback system that ONC has related to certification program complaints or concerns. And you can find information on that as well on our website. And this presentation was developed at taxpayer expense. Next slide. Okay, and Beth is, I'm going to present an overview, and Beth is going to present some of the Cures updates that we've made to the 2015 edition. Next slide. All right, so the purpose of the final rule, and as folks have heard me speak before the committee or just generally, I always say the importance of feedback. And we receive such a broad array of feedback from across the stakeholder communities, from patients, doctors, hospitals, developers, and just the public in general about what was important to them in our rule. And I do want to take an opportunity to thank everyone for doing that. And of course, we receive recommendations from the advisory committee. And we want to thank you for all of the time you spent across the different work groups, the task forces, to give us feedback. It has been truly helpful to have all of the feedback from all of the commenters as we were putting together the rule. As Don said, it does account for the number of pages because we want to make sure that we are responsive to the questions you have raised or the comments you have raised in each aspect of the rule. So in terms of the impact of the rule, this rule is successful when the entire health IT community engages. And there's different aspects in which that happens. And the design of the rule is to support the role of all of these players in what patients need. So supporting the ability of patients to have the right to their data, to control their data, to be part of their care team. And I just want to re-emphasize that, for the patient to be at the center and part of their care team so that they can help inform their own care as well. And part of that is having the data available to them. The provisions in the rule also support the ability of patients to be able to shop for their care and to really think about the environment of which their care is being given and more flexibility and options in terms of which provider they want to support them as on their journey. In terms of doctors and hospitals and generally the health community, we want to make sure that data is available there, that data requests can be easily and inexpensively fulfilled so that information gets to where it needs to go to support the care decisions. And some of that is also choice. So having a hospital system or a provider system that is locked into using a particular platform is not where we want to be. We want to be in an environment where hospital systems and doctors can create the right puzzle of technology to support the care for the patients that they serve. And that's really important. And there may be a particular app platform that benefits the provider's ability to do that. And maybe that can be built upon what they already have. So that ability to choose and have choice is really important to the care system and overall to the patient's care. So generally, we also think about developers, and developers are an important part of this equation. And having developers have the right information of what the government, what HHS expects will occur is important. So a lot of the rule also focuses on here's how you can support the flow of data, health IT developer. So you'll see that across the different provisions, whether it's in the conditions of certifications component around API requirements, among others, or whether it's in the information blocking section as it relates to how information can be moved to avoid an information blocking complaint, right? Because we do want to make sure information can move, that it can move easily, and move in the way that it needs to move so that it can be used. And some of that is how can you fulfill a request, and also what types of requests, which ways in which a request can be fulfilled is one part of it, but also the other part is when a request does not have to be fulfilled. And we'll talk a little bit about that later as well. And generally to the American public, we are all patients at some point in our life, and it's really important that information is available, that it can be used by the patient themselves. And that maximizes the ability of the public to have the innovative environment that they deserve and the transparency in healthcare that's necessary. Next slide. So a little bit on the history side of the equation. Information blocking, if we go back to around 2015, Congress asked us to develop a report that addressed information blocking, that identified, for example, the type of information blocking that might be occurring, and to analyze that, as well as to think through what might be some action items or strategies to support, to prevent information blocking from occurring. So we did that in 2015, and we did that from looking at what we were seeing in the industry because we were starting to hear those same complaints as well. After the report was released, Congress was also working on development of a law to think about health IT that later became the 21st Century Cures Act. In December 2016, that's when it was signed into law, and it includes Title IV, which I have spent the better part of several years focusing on, that deals with health IT. Some of those are regulatory requirements, others are not, but they're all the focus of what ONC is spending their time addressing. Next slide. So as it relates to some of the regulatory pieces to support implementation of Title IV, that's where you find the rule. So if you think about the rule, as folks on this call particularly know, there's two main sections. You have the conditions of certification, which relate to the health IT, to developers, health IT developers who are certified under our program, but you also have the information blocking provision, which is broader. There's other provisions. Beth Myers will talk a little bit later about the care continuum support that's included in the rule, particularly around supporting pediatric settings. But overall, that's kind of the structure of the rule. And as we were thinking about how to develop the rule and what to cover, we heard a lot from stakeholders. We even held meetings with OIG, the Office of the Inspector General, to hear more about the types of information blocking that were occurring, or the types of situations, I should say, where information was being impeded that folks thought or felt was information blocking. And knowing those types of examples helped to inform how we crafted the information blocking section of the rule. So through that listening and reviewing the complaints that we had received regarding information blocking, that led to our development of the rule. And I should note that not only do I have to thank our amazing ONC staff, and it takes really a village to develop a rule, who have helped to draft, to think through the policies for this rule, but I also have to thank our federal partners, whether it's Office of Inspector General, Office of Civil Rights, Federal Trade Commission, just across the landscape. We've heard a lot from our stakeholders. And of course, CMS, Denise was just on earlier, and they have really helped us to think through what they see on their aspect of healthcare to help us inform how we put together this rule. So after releasing the rule and proposed format, we received more than 2,000 comment submissions. Thank you very much. And then from there, we led to the development of the final rule, which was released and posted on our website last Monday. So getting to this point has been quite a journey and a very worthwhile one, not only because we're very excited about what we have in the final rule, but it has helped us to really see what's happening on the ground. And I always say what we've developed here in this rule or in any policy that we're doing at ONC, we really want to make sure that it works on the ground. So all of the feedback we received along the way has created a final rule that we believe will do just that. Next slide. And now we're going to transition. We'll talk a little bit about some of the tweaks we've made to the 2015 edition rule in terms of the criteria that are required. So let me turn it over to Beth Myers, who's my deputy. Beth?
Hi, thank you, Elise. Thank you, everyone, for joining us today. I'm going to try and make this fast so we can get closer to back on time. Mostly wanted to take a minute to highlight some specific things that HITECH has been interested in and specifically commented on, and also give a high-level overview of what our approach was for the updates that we've made to the 2015 edition certification criteria. So first off, in the proposed rule, we did propose that these would be updates to the 2015 edition rather than an entirely new edition of technology. As you all know, having made similar comments, that there were some concerns about that and a lot of discussion about whether it should be a new edition or whether there should be some other pathway that allowed for it to be differentiated so that it wouldn't cause confusion. Someone talked very quickly about a couple things that we're doing. And then later on, you'll hear more about that as the weeks progress, because there are specific things outside of the regulation that we'll be working with developers to do to help mitigate any confusion about what the updates are and how they work in terms of timing. So what we did in determining what the scope should be was really try to analyze historically what has been the impact of being sort of restricting updates to doing a new edition. What has the impact of a new edition been, both on health IT developers, but also on healthcare providers?
and what should justify an update to the addition versus an entirely new addition. Historically, an entirely new addition has been captured and implemented across the industry as an entirely new product, and that is both on the developer side but also on the provider expectation side. Because of that, it essentially creates an artificial crunch on an update cycle. That means that all of the health IT developers that are participating in the program and all of the healthcare providers that use that technology to participate in CMS programs are updating wholesale an entire product all at the same time. And we've seen the type of issues that that can create with delays, with significant burden on development teams and on providers in being able to mitigate that cost within their potential system needs and enterprise needs. So having just done that with the 2019 year to update to the 2015 edition itself, we found that that was a pretty high bar to justify another such update that might cause those types of delays and burdens on both providers and developers. So when we analyzed what we had proposed and determined what we were finalizing, we determined that it did not in fact meet that bar for that type of update, but rather should be updates or that type of new addition change, but rather should be updates to the existing criteria. With that in mind, we specifically aimed to try and make some common sense adjustments based on the feedback we heard through public comment about how we selected what was going to be updated, how we portrayed what was going to be updated in the regulatory structure, and how we understand that scope over time in terms of what developers would have to certify to versus what would be an update that is made over time as part of the conditions. And you'll hear more about the conditions and maintenance of certification aspect of that in the next set of presentation today. So I want to really touch base on just a couple highlights here. Time-limited and removed criteria, that is describing specifically those things that we determined are outdated or needed to be updated with standards or updated to have that standard essentially make a replacement to the existing criterion. Several of these you'll see on the left-hand side are things that were previously associated with stage one or stage two of the meaningful use programs, the EHR incentive programs, CMS and the Medicaid version. Some of those are time limited, so they will not be removed until Medicaid participants program has sunset so that they're still available for them for those program purposes. I did want to highlight that problem list, medication list, med allergy list does not mean that those data elements are going away. It means that the specific certification of how those data elements is captured will no longer be a certification requirement. And that's really important to understand that those things are still being captured. That data is still extant in an EHR. We're no longer specifically requiring developers to adhere to a single pathway in order to capture that data. So I want to talk a little bit about the revised criteria. A highlight in there is the interoperability criteria that are being updated with the US CDI. I have a slide on the US CDI, so I will touch on that really quickly next. But I did want to point out that this does include I've made a bucket of the interoperability criteria, and what it does include is the CCDA, so the criteria that reference the CCDA. It also includes the view, download, transmit. So there have been some questions about whether the patient, quote-unquote, patient portal is included for a US CDI update. The answer is yes, it is. It also includes an update for the CCDA to include the CCDA companion guide. Important point about that will be mentioned again in the conditions of certification and maintenance of certification section of our agenda today, but I did want to point out with relation to the 24-month timeline. The 24-month timeline is the end of the update cycle. Essentially, health IT developers can begin doing that update immediately, and specifically with the US CDI, we tried to constrain the updates to that data set itself. First off, it's based on the common clinical data set, but the updates that we've made to the US CDI were aimed to be a constrained set of common sense choices that are largely already existent to try and make sure that it is very much focused on interoperability, and I'm going to talk a little bit more about it in a minute, but to try and allow for that development to begin to happen now, we have put in place that certification can move forward with US CDI essentially immediately. And the 24 months is the end point at which everything would have to transition over. Really quickly mentioning the right side, security tag, send and receive, that was something we heard loud and clear from the HITACC about the data segmentation for privacy criterion. They are voluntary criterion, but we heard pretty loud and clear that they needed to be reframed because it doesn't solve the whole issue of how to do data segmentation and actually implement segmentation rules based on whether it's a state law or a federal law or specific privacy constraints that you might have based on opioid use disorder or issues relating to emancipated minors, those types of things. So instead, we've renamed those criteria to specifically focus on the actual tagging of the data, which is really what that tool does. It allows you to tag the data at a granular level so that other pathways by which you might be implementing rules can be more easily facilitated. And we do specifically talk about it as a voluntary criterion and aim to target those specific use cases that I mentioned, behavioral health, opioid use disorder, and pediatric care. The two immediately below that, electronic prescribing and CQM, both are aligning the criterion to requirements that CMS has for electronic prescribing for Part D. We are aligning with the same standard that CMS has already begun implementing as of January 1st of this year. And for CQM report criterion, that is aligning with the CMS implementation guide for the QRDA. So it actually removes a layer of certification burden on developers by having them just immediately be certifying to the CMS requirement rather than doing a double-layered thing with the QRDA standard itself. The new criteria, I'm just going to point out two quick things there. First, the electronic health information export, really important point on this one. I think you're going to hear the word alignment over and over again. And I appreciate the comments earlier that Denise made about alignment. So not only have we aligned the USCDI across criteria, and as Denise mentioned, it's in the CMS rule, it's also mentioned in the TEFCA, but we've also aligned the definition of EHI here for this criterion to align with the information blocking definition of EHI. That was something we heard loud and clear, both from the HITACC as well as from public comment, that alignment was essential for these specific definitions of the types of data sets that we're talking about. So Mike will actually talk about that definition a little bit more later on when we're talking about information blocking, but for that criterion, it is specifically aligned to the information blocking definition of electronic health information. The standardized API for patient population services, I think the big headline highlight there, and I know Avinash and Rob will be talking about that a little bit more in conditions of certification and maintenance of certification, but I get to say the highlight, which is that we are talking about release 4, which you all probably already know given that it's been mentioned several times so far, but that is the highlight for that criterion. So we will move on to the next slide. So I did want to mention very quickly, and then I think we've officially gone over time, but at least the same amount over time, so we'll move on. But the USCDI, a quick thing to note here that we did, again, try and constrain this to things that are sort of common sense updates. It is based on the CCDS. We have adopted the following new required data classes and data elements: the provenance, clinical notes, the pediatric vital signs, and address, email, and phone number. I did want to point those out specifically being address, email, and phone number being the things that we were identified for patient matching, to support patient matching use cases. So that is the update to the USCDI. I think we'll probably have some follow-up later on to talk more about that in more detail. But I did want to reiterate that when we talk about the USCDI within the criterion, within the criteria, I should say, for those interoperability criteria, those updates can be made over the next 24 months. So it can be certified to the CCDS or the USCDI for 24 months. At the end of the 24 months, it switches to exclusively the USCDI, and that is referring to the certification program and the certification requirements and the specific standards associated with the data classes and data elements. Mike will talk a little bit more about, I think, the what Elise was also mentioning and what was in Stephen's question earlier about the relationship between the USCDI and information blocking, which is separate from the certification criterion that implements US CDI for the API, for instance, or for the view, download, transmit criterion that is specific to the certification program of the technology to meet those standards. So those are, it is the same concept of data elements, but it is a different approach to how it's affected. So Mike will touch on that later. I think with that, I will pause so I don't go far past what we've already gone over, and we can try and get a little bit more back on schedule.
Thanks. In terms of schedule, I see that we are still on a solid 15 minutes behind, and I know we have had a question from HITAC members about getting started on another HITAC meeting or work group dedicated specifically to COVID-19. I've been in touch with ONC leadership behind the scenes during this last presentation, and HITAC members, we are going to use the break time to start the conversation and try to hear from you what your top priorities would be to discuss in this next meeting, work group venue, whatever that turns out to be. With that, I think we're going to move on to the next presentation now so that we can at least get an overview of all the general areas of the new rule today. And with that, I will hand the mic over to Avinash and Robert and Michael.
So this is Rob. I will start. I will be joined by Avinash Shambhag, who is the Executive Director of our Office of Technology, and also Mike Lipinski, who is the Director of our Federal Policy and Regulatory Affairs Division. My name is Rob Anthony. I'm the Director of our Certification and Testing Division, which oversees the certification program here at ONC. And today we're going to try and give you a short summary about all that is packed into the conditions and maintenance of certification bucket. Can we go to the next slide? So Congress required through the Cures Act that we establish this concept of conditions and maintenance of certification for the certification program, and specifically enjoined us to look at these particular areas that had to be covered, and we'll cover each of these on information blocking, assurances, and so forth. The only section that we're not going to cover here is the EHR reporting criteria, which also is required by the Cures Act, but we have deferred to future rulemaking. I think the important thing to understand as we go through this is, one, we have finalized an approach here where we have an initial certification requirement in some of these areas for Health IT developers or the Health IT module, and then there are ongoing maintenance requirements for continued certification. A developer would have to meet both of those requirements to continue their certification. And I think it's also important to understand here that we are talking about requirements for developers and or their certified Health IT modules here, especially as we move forward. It is easy to confuse some of these things and think that they may apply more broadly, but these conditions are specifically conditions for ongoing certification compliance with the program. So if we can move to the next slide. Sorry, we can move on to the next. This is our overall for conditions. I think this is a great example, information blocking, the first condition of certification, where we differentiate between where there may be other programmatic requirements. We will cover information blocking this afternoon in a later presentation about how information blocking covers a number of folks that you'll see over here in this right-hand block. It applies to providers. It applies to developers of certified Health IT and HIEs and HINs. But what we're talking about here is a specific condition of certification that applies to Health IT developers and actions that are taken specific to their certified Health IT module. And that is simply that, this prohibits any Health IT developer who has a Health IT product that is certified under our program from taking any kind of an action that would constitute information blocking overall. There's not a maintenance requirement beyond continued compliance with that requirement. Next slide. The The second condition of certification overall is the condition for assurances. In many ways, this is not terribly different than what I think developers are used to in the current program. You are providing an assurance as a developer that you conform to the full scope of certification criteria to which your Health IT module has been certified. It is a little bit business as usual. It's just the addition, I think, of some of the new cures items that are required now. You have to make the full capabilities of what you have available to your clients. You are not taking any action that constitutes information blocking. You are disclosing and attesting what is available to your clients and publicly. There are some maintenance of certification requirements pertaining to record keeping. But overall, I think assurances really is just providing an assurance to ONC and to the ACB that you are meeting the full compliance requirements for certification. What I think is you'll find in this area as you go through the rule is this fifth condition of certification, and we'll talk about this on the next slide, which is related to EHI export. Beth touched on this a little bit. Next slide, please. Beth talked about this a little bit in the sort of new criteria. This is, for those of you who are familiar with our regulatory shorthand, this is the B10 criteria in which if your product of which your certified module is a part stores electronic health information, then you have to certify within 36 months to this EHI export criterion. You will see the general requirements on the side. There are two case areas by which you will have to certify. One is for single patient electronic health information export, and the other is for patient population in general. This allows for two scenarios that we actually discussed in the final rule. It allows patients to fully access and move their health information across systems. It also allows providers to be able to move entire EHI for entire patient populations and migrate between products if they so desire. So we will move to the next slide. And here I will hand this over to Mike Lipinski to talk about the communications condition of certification.
Thanks, Rob. Good morning, everyone. I guess I should shout out for the caveat. You should not read anything into it that they're asking an attorney to talk to you about this condition of certification. As I think it's more so just that I had worked closely with some other staff on this one. So as a reminder, there were six areas called out in the Cures Act, and you see them on your screen, to which a developer could not prohibit or restrict communications. And the key part is about certified health IT modules, as all the conditions are limited to certified health IT. Another key piece, obviously, is anything outside of these six areas can be prohibited and restricted by a health IT developer. In the final rule, we answered some questions and provided some clarifications regarding some of our interpretation of these terms, but generally speaking, they remain the same as we had proposed our interpretations. Moving on to the next slide. So what we did, is balance what Congress gave us in terms of the prohibitions and restrictions with the rights, so to speak, or the interests of health IT developers. So we created what are called unqualified protections for certain communications, which you see on the screen, and then we had a separate category called, and I'll talk to you permitted restrictions and prohibitions. So those would be areas where developers would be allowed to put restrictions. For the unqualified, we identified both the types of communications as well as who the communications are being made to, in which we said there would be no restrictions permitted. So as you see on your screen here, those are them. Can't really say much more about them than what you see. But a lot of our basis, or at least one of our basis, was the importance of these type of disclosures, but also that we felt that most developers' interests would still be protected in when these communications occurred, because as you see on the screen, many of these entities already have in place means to protect protect the information that's provided to them and not subsequently redisclose that information, particularly to the public, unless it was in a different form that, you know, protected, for example, intellectual property rights. Let's move to the next screen, and when we move to the next screen, I'm going to pause for a second to make a note of, I think, a point that applies to all communications. And we've made clear in the rule that, you know, communications are broad. The statute should provide any definition of communications. So obviously they include written and verbal, but we also want to be clear that they include visual communications. And we had talked about visual communications in the proposed rule, particularly screenshots, which is a form of visual communication, similar to, like, if you took a picture of a Picasso, so that you could then highlight on that picture things that you thought were imperfections that proved that was a false, you know, copy of an original Picasso. So we make clear in the rule that those are included as well. And we also make clear, which we did through examples in the proposed rule, that the communication was not limited to the form or medium in which it was communicated. So putting together what I've just told you, a screenshot provided on YouTube, you know, could be potentially a protected communication, consistent, as long as it's consistent with the other prohibitions and restrictions I'm going to talk to you about. So on the screen here, you see three of the there were five particular ones that we identified: developer, employees and contractors, non-user facing aspects. An obvious one of that is any type of source code. So even, you shouldn't, as a developer, you should feel confident that no one's putting up, you know, even if it's a security risk, your source code to point out the error, you know, in the coding that will allow for, you know, malware or a cyber attack. That, however, could be disclosed to, you know, one of the entities that we've identified on the other unqualified protection, such as a government agency that can help deal with that. Key to point out here is the intellectual property protection that we've provided, so to speak, for developers. We continue, though, to maintain, so they are allowed to put restrictions on communications if they are to protect a developer's legitimate intellectual property issues, as long as they're no broader than necessary and they are consistent with these other permitted prohibitions and restrictions. And that includes the screenshots and visual communications that we'll talk to about in a moment. However, I want to point out again that we permit, we continue to carve out that if it's a, under copyright, if it's a fair use of the work, see up on your screen the exact language, then they could not restrict such communication, those being the developers. So let's move to the next screen. All right, so as I was alluding to, screenshots and video. So when I was talking to you earlier about visual communications, video is also a form of visual communication, not just screenshots. So you'll see that here in the final rule now, both in preamble discussion and in reg text. And what we've done is we continue to limit the sharing of both screenshots and video. And you can see here the video is limited to only where it's the only way to address, say, a temporal matter. So maybe a latency issue with how orders are entered on the screen, and that could lead to a duplicative ordering and therefore a safety issue, a usability issue. So we've, again, the other piece I think worth mentioning is we've not made developers responsible for third-party IP. So that's going to be at, you know, the users is going to have to be aware, but it's not the developer, as we had proposed, would have to figure out what was all the third-party in each of the screens and or video, and then redact that or try to actually, as we propose, attempt to obtain a waiver for its disclosure. Let's move to the, and obviously we maintain the pre-market testing and development as well as one of the prohibited prohibition, or one of the potential prohibitions or restrictions. I also want to point out, next screen real quickly, there's a lot to talk about here, but so the maintenance piece, we received a lot of comments on the maintenance fees, including from HITACH, the one, you know, asking for more time really to amend contracts. And I think we agreed with that there would be additional time necessary, and we felt that the notification piece would be a substantial mitigating factor in terms of when the contracts were amended. So generally speaking, notification about any provisions in the contract that contravene this communications condition of certification have to be annually provided. So once in this first year, and then annually thereafter, notices to your customers, if you're a developer, about any provisions that contravene this condition and that they are not enforceable. Then what we're asking is, you know, we had proposed in a reasonable period of time and not longer than 2 years to amend the contracts to remove such provisions. We're saying now that developers have up until, you know, the normal process they use to amend and revise their contracts. So whether it's in regards to, you know, new services provided to their customers and they're going to amend the contract for that, or if it's related to, you know, potentially something state or federal privacy laws. As you all know, there's a HIPAA rulemaking in the works. So if that comes to fruition, that there needs to be a change for one of those reasons, we would expect to be changes made regarding this condition of certification at that time, the appropriate ones, obviously. At this point, I think it's time for me to turn it back over to, is it to, I'm not sure, I'll turn it over to Rob. It might be Avinash is up next, though.
Actually, it goes to Avinash next.
Yeah. Hey, Mike, this is Avinash. Thank you very much. Again, good morning, everyone. My name is Avinash Shanbhag. I'll spend a few minutes providing details about the API condition of certification. First, to reiterate what Rob mentioned earlier, the API condition certification applies to practices associated only with the API-focused certification criteria, which we have defined as the certified API technology, and do not generally apply to other software interfaces. At a high level, the API condition certification established in the final rule address practices of health IT developers. These are common sense practices such as transparency condition that talk about requirements of publication of documentation for app developers to be able to use the APIs efficiently, fees condition that talk about what are permitted fees and what are prohibited fees from being charged by certified API developers. Those are the health IT developers that are part of the certification program. And the business requirements around the use of APIs by app developers so that app developers can efficiently and effectively use these APIs. Can we go to the next slide, please? As you see, the API conditions are meant to complement the technical capabilities specified for APIs in the final rule and seek to minimize the special effort necessary to use API technology. Specifically, these API conditions apply to the developer practices associated with the three previously finalized API functional criteria that we had finalized in the 2015 edition certification in 2015. And the new Fire release 4 based API, read-only API criteria for single and population services that has been finalized in this QoS rule. It is also worth noting that the scope of EHI is limited to the data elements specified in the US CDI. Can we go to the next slide, please? I'll give you a high-level description of the three conditions of certification associated with API. First is the transparency condition. In here, we have specified and clarified the publication requirements on certified API developers for all their business and technical documentation that's necessary for API users, that are the app developers that use these APIs, to be able to interact with the APIs appropriately. So those are things that are like documentation and the publication via publicly accessible hyperlinks that are responsibility of the API developers. In the fees condition, we have set conditions and criteria for allowable fees and guidelines for fees that certified API developers are permitted to charge and also to whom those fees can be charged. There are, at a high level, three categories of fees that are permitted to be charged by certified API developers. These are, the first one is the development, deployment, and upgrade fees. These are the fees that certified API developers can charge to their customers, the health organizations that purchase their products. There is an API usage cost that is allowed if the API developers are hosting the services on behalf of their customers, so they're able to recoup the cost that they incur. And finally, there is a value-added services permitted fees that can be charged by the certified API developers to the users of API, so those are the app developers, in case for services that go beyond what is necessary to use the APIs. So in our rule, we kind of give examples of value-added services such as additional training, educational materials, or even if you have an app store and if there is some, there are some services that enable apps to be kind of provided maybe a placement in the app store at a position that benefits them. Those are all which go beyond, which are required to support an effective use of those APIs are allowed and are considered evaluated services. In general, any fees not permitted by these conditions are prohibited from being imposed. And finally, we have the openness and pro-competitive condition. These are the business requirements to ensure that the API users, the app developers, and the health organizations that purchase the product are given independent ability to use the API technology, just to make sure that they have all the rights and abilities to make the maximum use of these APIs to improve interoperability and perform and do innovative activities on top of these APIs. So these are the kind of high-level common sense condition certification. There are obviously details on each of the different conditions that are specified in the regulation. Can we go to the next slide, please? And as kind of we have structured all our condition certification, we also have within the API condition certification a maintenance of certification requirements, which are the ongoing set of condition requirements that are to be met by the certified API developers. We have a category of a set of requirements that are only specific to the new standards-based API. And these are the ones that are highlighted on the screen, which I'll describe briefly. These are in the categories of verifying the authenticity of the app developer or the user of the API. These pertain to the application registration and the publication of service-based URL. A certified API developer is permitted to institute a process. So they are not required, but are permitted to institute a process to verify the authenticity of the app developer, so long as the process is objective, is same for all the app developers, and is completed within 10 business days. Once the app developer is verified, the registration process for the application is required to be completed within 5 business days of completing its verification. Again, from the NPRM, during the proposed rule we had for verifying authenticity, we had proposed 5 days, and for registering, we had proposed 1 day, and based on the responses, we have increased the dates to accommodate commenters' response. And finally, certified API developers are required to publish service-based URLs. These are the fire endpoints for all its customers of certified API technology that can be used by patients to access their EHI. So these are the patient-facing endpoints, and these are kind of, again, in our in our rule, we finalized that these are kind of important and necessary ingredients for app developers to be able to use and use the APIs efficiently. So we require, as part of maintenance or certification, for certified API developers to publish these FHIR endpoints for all its customers. With that, there are a few, couple of more maintenance of requirements that talk about timelines for rolling out the API conditions certification and also the overall timelines when the new API criteria, the standards-based API criteria need to be provided to the customers. These are all aligned, as was mentioned previously by my colleagues, Beth and Denise, that they are aligned with the overall timelines. And I'll we have in further in this presentation, we have an overall timeline where all the conditions are to be met, and that time Rob will be covering those. So with that, I'm going to turn over back to this time Rob to continue with giving you more details of the remaining conditions of certification.
Thanks, Avinash. Can we go to the next slide? So I think the other major area concept to cover in conditions of certification is real-world testing. There's an awful lot to unpack from a regulatory perspective within this condition, but I'm going to focus mostly on sort of the high-level concepts that you'll find here. And from a high level, it's actually, I think, a pretty a common sense sort of concept. Congress, through the Cures Act, required help IT developers to basically test real-world use of technology for interoperability in the settings in which it was going to be deployed. And so what we have put together as condition of certification here and the ongoing maintenance is something that will allow developers to verify the extent to which their certified health IT modules deployed in a production environment demonstrate conformance with the full scope of whatever certification criteria they have to comply with within those particular workflows or architectures or type of cares that they are deployed in. We put some parameters around what things have to be part of that test. And if you look at this condition of certification here on the slide, that is what this regulatory shorthand refers to. The criteria within 315B, for example, are specific functionalities within Health IT criteria, like transitions of care, which is B1, or B3, which is e-prescribing. So we outline a number of things that refer to different criteria that would be applicable as that relate to interoperability as a whole. If you look at the maintenance of certification, I think that's really where the sort of meat of what this criteria overall or this condition overall really addresses. And this is this notion that developers will submit a real-world testing plan, and they will do that by the end of every calendar year, and then not immediately the following year, but after slightly more than a year of sort of accumulating information, they will submit real-world testing results about that plan that they submitted. We put some requirements around what has to be included in that plan. There are different things related to, you know, what standards are applied and the methodologies that they're using and outlining what that detail is. But essentially, it all comes down to the same thing, is that you are looking at what your module is certified to, and you are employing a number of different measures related to the real-world application of that technology within that thing as a whole. That information is made publicly available via a hyperlink. We are at this point in time looking at how we can publish that through the chapel so that it will be easily and publicly available to folks, both the plan and the results from the developer. I think important to distinguish here that this is a these testing plans are not necessarily per individual module. They are per developer and per applicable criteria and per setting of care or applicable workflow. So it is possible, especially for vendors that have a large number of health IT modules, that they'll be able to bundle some of those together, so that will not be as burdensome on them to submit. It is also important, I think, to distinguish, because we have started to get this question about the applicability to providers. And again, I would emphasize conditions of certification are applicable to developers and to certified products. They are not applicable to providers. So this is a condition real-world testing that providers should not have to take part in. It should be something that is under the hood, behind the curtain, and will not affect them overall. Next slide. You will see as you dig into this section that there are some things that are dependent within this on some of those criteria within the real-world testing plan. So overall, there will be some requirements to both update certified health IT modules as applicable and also roll out to customers things like the USCDI, things like updates to the newest standards for CCDA, electronic prescribing. There are some other privacy and security things that also depend on this. But again, this is all on the developer side, and the reason that it is folded into real-world testing is that there will be a requirement to update this and get these out to the end user of products within that 24-month period, and then ultimately afterwards, after they have been deployed, to have them folded into the real-world testing plan. So again, you can demonstrate conformance of them in an actual production environment. Next slide. One of the concepts that you will also find, and I think this is an important concept for moving health IT as a whole forward more nimbly, is this notion of the standards version advancement process. We finalized this notion of allowing the option for developers to advance to a next approved standard in a list, so that we can better align with overall industry efforts. There are many times where the development cycle of a standard may be out of step with what our regulatory process as a whole is. And what we wanted to do is provide better alignment for the industry as a whole and more flexibility for the industry as a whole. So allowing developers, once we approve use of a newer standard as part of the SVAP, as we're calling it, the standards version advancement process, to be able to select and use that standard for your certified health IT module. You would have to, you'll see this, how it works. You would have to, as a developer, you would have to let both your ACB and all of your customers know that you are updating that and how that update will affect you and whether you will support previous versions of it. But in the end, really what this does is allow people to move forward with newer standards that we think may be ready to be implemented, but we have not yet fully adopted as part of the 2015 edition within a regulatory framework. It is included within real-world testing because, again, if you update in this way as a developer, you will need to demonstrate your conformance to the full criteria certification requirements in that area, and you will have to show how this newer standard that has been adopted is being tested in a deployed production environment overall. This will be a public process, the SVAP as a whole, and we're releasing more information on that in, I think, weeks to come, but it will be a process by which folks will be able to nominate some potential standards for advancements. We will ultimately consider them. We will gather some information, and ultimately the national coordinator will decide on approving specific standards for advancement and adoption moving forward. Next slide.
I'm sorry to interrupt. This is Lauren. Just wanted to see if we could move along and just kind of wrap this last section up in the next couple minutes, and then we'll
have
Robert and Carolyn adjust the agenda. Thank you. Appreciate it.
I probably have all of 2 to 3 minutes left of things to say. So the final attestation or the final criteria is attestation. This is a very simple concept. You are basically attesting to meeting the previous conditions of certification. This is something that the first window will not open until next year, April 1st. But essentially, there will be attestations submitted every 6 months. You'll have a 30-day window for health IT developers, again, to submit those attestations to having met those conditions of certification, again, a requirement of the Cures Act overall. Next slide. The way that we will enforce this, and I'm not going to dwell on this, but I just wanted to mention that we are leveraging the direct review process that we already use for overall ONC surveillance. Within that process, there is a way for us to take a look at what is happening within areas of certification with product. We may ask for extra documentation. If there is a nonconformity, it results in a corrective action plan. Ultimately, if a developer does not follow the corrective action plan, it can lead to a certification ban. There's a process for that, but all of this is a process that I think developers are already familiar with. Next slide. And if you were to look at the whole sort of timeline of certification, we included this. I'm not going to go into the individual on this, but there are a number of things that I think will take effect in sort of a cascading way. There are deadlines here for when compliance starts with information blocking and deadlines for when the first real-world testing plans and attestations, but this is just meant to describe what that cascading will look like. There will be a number of things that happen over the next 6 months, 18 months, 24 months, 36 months. It's not something that sort of happens all at once. Next slide. And I think that is it for where we are. So I will break there.
Great. Thank you very much. So folks, a couple things. Obviously, we have been challenged with our schedule, as we often are, which is a good thing. I think we've got a lot to get through. Carolyn and I and the ONC team have been discussing a number of things in the background during this last presentation, and I think our plan forward is we're going to hold the discussion, even though we've had a number of presentations right now. We want to continue the presentations, and I know that a number of you have some comments and questions, and then we'll also try to give you a sense of where we are in terms of, we heard a lot of interest in talking about health information technology and COVID-19, and so what we'd like to do, and I'll give you some time to think about this, is we would like to solicit what you think your what the priority should be if we were to create some sort of a work group to do this. Obviously, there's a time pressure here. We need to stay very focused on what's doable and attainable here. We can't necessarily take on everything. So what I'd like to do is proceed with the next presentation, give you some time to think about your priorities. I think we'll take a small break in between the next presentation and the final presentation to start soliciting some of those priorities that you feel, and then we'll try to circle back with a plan of how we can incorporate those priorities into either a working group or another special meeting of the entire committee or a work group. And again, at 12:45, we have a scheduled public comment period. So as in our practice, we will take a break at that point and honor our commitment to the public to allow them to comment. We may have a little bit of time extra at the end of the meeting, and that time we'll use for a continued discussion of the presentations if we don't have enough time for that, as well as ongoing discussion of the COVID-19 priorities. So, with that, I would ask our next presenter to go ahead and I think that is on our 21st century final rule in the area of blocking, information blocking. And that will be led by Michael, I believe.
Thanks, Robert. Okay, I will jump right in. I understand we have a tight schedule, so I'll try to go not too fast, but at a decent clip. And in that regard, I should mention, yesterday we gave a Monday, I think, right? Anyway, my staff or our team can tell me, but I think it was Monday. We gave a presentation on the information blocking in the afternoon. It was a pretty in-depth presentation. It was an hour and 15 minutes. The slides from that will be made available online, as well as a recording of the entire presentation. And then obviously you can continue to reach out to us if you have a question. So let's move, jump right in and move to the next slide. I tried to highlight, and so this is a resuscitation here of, you know, what we were asked to do by Congress, and we tried to stay true to that throughout the both the entire rulemaking and definitely with the final rule. Moving to the next slide. So this is something a slide I've used in the proposed rule and other colleagues have used, and it kind of is, you know, information blocking maybe in some respects in the simplest form, a type of checklist on what do you have to have to be an information blocker. And we'll talk about I think a couple of the important ones I'll focus on more today here. Let's move to the next slide. So also very important, and I know there's been some discussions today about timelines, but what we had finalized is that all actors subject to the information blocking provision, so developers, health information networks, providers, they would not have to comply with information blocking for until 6 months past the publication date of the rule, which obviously has not occurred yet. The other key point that we've pulled out and put on the slide is that the Office of Inspector General has not yet issued their civil monetary penalties rule, not even the proposed rule yet, that it's still under review at OMB. And until they finalize that, they've indicated there would be obviously no enforcement before the 6 months, and then at minimum you have 6 months. And what they've said, they'll exercise discretion if they were to, say, for example, issue the rule, another 6 months after that, for that in between time, they would exercise discretion as to enforcement. The other piece I think also worth mentioning that I did during our presentation is that, there's an executive order out there. It was from the administration back in October. It's 13892. They issued two executive orders at the time, 13891 and 13892, two focusing on essentially pre-enforcement actions. And so we've cited that in the rule, and we've always encouraged self-disclosure, and we continue to do that, whether it's related to the program or related to the information blocking. And once that executive order is fully implemented, there may be opportunity for advisory opinions as well related to information blocking. So I just want to make you aware of that. Moving on to the next slide. So the actors. Obviously, there were four actors identified by Congress. We received a lot of comments, practically on, I wouldn't say all of them so much, but definitely on the developers and the health information networks in particular. I'm going to spend my most time talking to you about the health information networks. Providers, it was identified in statute who was a healthcare provider via cross-reference to the Public Health Service Act, which CURES amended. So we've maintained that definition. Developers, we've maintained the definition that we've proposed with two things worth mentioning. One being we've incorporated the fact that self-developers are excluded from the definition for information blocking, but they're obviously still going to be subject to the condition of certification related to information blocking. And then we've also focused on just having the claim has to be at a time when a developer has a certified product. So there was a discussion in the proposed rule, if you recall, and request for comment as to whether there should be some type of liability for a developer if it no longer had any products in the program, but at one time did. we've finalized it where, again, they need to have a product in the program at the time of the information blocking claim for any liability. So let's move to the next slide and talk a little bit about Health Information Network and Health Information Exchange. It was, I think, probably where some of your most discussion was. And hopefully you can continue to hear me because not a lot of mine, I had to make sure my VPN stayed connected there and they asked for my password. So Health Information Network, we're back to where we were. What we ended up doing, based on all the comment, is made four changes. The final definition you'll see on the screen there. The key one, I think, for they're all key in my opinion, but one of the big ones was we received a lot of comment about confusion as to the difference between a health information network and a health information exchange. In the final rule, we have the same definition for both. So there, we know out in the industry, there's even other terms used for these same type of entities, REOs or health information organizations, so forth. So that's one key change. Another change is we've tried to make what you need to do, what type of actions you needed to partake in to be considered a HIN. We've tried to focus those more. So one of the big ones is we remove substantially influence. In response to the comment, there was a lot of concern about that being broad and vague. And so we've removed that. We've also focused, and this is, I think, a theme you'll see throughout the whole final rule, particularly when it comes to information blocking, is that we continue to focus our alignment with HIPAA because we understand that many of the actors under the information blocking provision are also subject to the HIPAA privacy and security rules as being either a covered entity or a business associate. So we focused again on, as you see, treatment, payment, and healthcare operations. So the exchange needs to be related to that. And then the third, the fourth big change is in the proposed rule, we talked to there being only two entities plus the individual entity that is the HIN needed to be exchanging for there to be a health information network. So generally, we heard about between all the things that we have, whether, the type of actions that they need to be doing and that piece right there, and also the piece without the focusing on just treatment, payment, and healthcare, that we would be covering, pretty much everything out there as a HIN was, generalized feedback we received. So between these actions, we feel like it narrows the focus to the type of entities we're trying to cover. And to say a little more about the two, more than two affiliated, unaffiliated entities that are enabled to exchange. So obviously that means three or more, stated another way. They have to have the ability as well as a discretion exchange. So you may have the ability but choose not to exchange in the network or at least on particular use cases. And that's okay. But as long as you're enabled to do or have the ability and the discretion to do so, that would count as, one of the unaffiliated entities. And I guess maybe as an example, what this we think, prevents the unintentional inclusion of would be like, what are essentially bilateral exchanges. So if you had like multiple providers sending information to what, I'll just refer to as quote unquote an intermediary or a clearinghouse, and then they were sending the information on to registries or government reporting agencies, that would not be a HIN because the providers aren't exchanging between themselves through that intermediary, or the receiving entities on the other end aren't really exchanging back with either with themselves using the services or the agreements of that intermediary or exchanging with the other parties. So we think this definition still achieves our policy goal, but is administratable and provides the clarity that stakeholders were asking for. Let's move to the next slide. EHI, another area where we received a lot of comments about it being, that our proposed definition being overly broad. Again, going back to those actors, so to speak, that would be covered under the information blocking rule and also be covered under HIPAA rules, they pointed out based on our definition, there could be the need to segregate data, having, you know, data that is EHI and data that is EPHI. And that was never our intent with our proposal. So we've, in the final rule, in this, in some respects, and, you know, some comments made by HITACH, maybe not in the way that you guys provided your comments, but has, let's say, pieces of those thoughts that you were providing. So it's EPHI found in the designated record set. That is what we are focusing on right now at this time for EHI. And so we think that is, again, should be administratable, just like the HIN definition. Many of our actors that are going to be covered under this information blocking provision have familiarity with this information that the EPHI found the designated record set. They're already collecting it, maintaining it, making it available, and we believe it's widely understood. So therefore, we think it is practical and operational in that respect. The one thing, as you see on the screen here, you, our task force had a, the HITACH task force had a lot of conversations about this, and we received over, I think it was over 1,000 submissions just on price information. But how it would work with our definition that we finalize is that it's not expressly included, as you see on the screen, or excluded. And if it's in the designated record set, then it would be considered EHI. That's pretty much the bottom line on that. Moving on to the next slide. So I want to highlight here, and this is where, if you go back to that slide about the elements of information blocking, this is a key element because, and rightfully so, we got a lot of comments on the two things I talked to you about already, you know, that all actors, but particularly Health Information Network, and then obviously the definition of EHI, and an immense amount of comments on the exceptions. But these, this this element of information blocking is just as important as whether or not you meet an exception, because if you don't have an interference, then you're not going to be an information blocker. Or if you have an interference, you still may qualify for an exception, and you, then you wouldn't be an information blocker. So on the screen, and I encourage you, as I've, you know, we've heard, a lot of you are already, you know, steeped in reading the rule. I can encourage you to read this part of the rule of information blocking. It's in, I'm trying to remember where the page numbers were, 640 and 650-ish around there. Off the top of my head, we have other examples of what is an interference, but I highlighted three key ones on the screen here today. Pretty self-explanatory when it comes to the FHIR endpoint. We view that as a technical interference if it wasn't made available, and so they should be made available. Delays, well, we don't set a particular time frame because obviously that's going to be circumstantial. Then we'll have to look at that at case by case. Delays can be considered an interference and have been used, and we've heard from stakeholders that they've been used as ways to block access, exchange, and use of EHI. And the other key one that we've, you know, had in the proposed rule and maintained in the final rule is that if there's any charging for what is called electronic access, and we've made clear what we mean by electronic access in the final rule, and I'll just repeat that for all of you here today. And so we define it as an interbased method that makes EHI available at the time the EHI is requested, where no manual effort is required to fulfill the request. So if you're charging for that electronic access, then that's inherently suspect and in terms of an interference. Let's move, and as I was saying to you earlier, and I'll note it again, it's a good discussion of what vetting is acceptable and what vetting would cross the line and be inherently suspect as an interference also in the preamble of the rule. Moving to the next slide, so let's talk just briefly about what is not an interference. We received a lot of comments, including from the HITACH, about business associate agreements. And I think, again, aligning with HIPAA, we're not asking anyone to violate their business associate agreement, particularly their service level agreements that implement those business associate agreements. However, one key part to this is they cannot be discriminatory. And what I mean by that is if you're sharing information, say for treatment, and you're sharing it with, you know, 10 providers of a patient, but you've chosen not to share with a particular provider of a patient, then that's going to be inherently suspect related to, you know, why that practice is and why you're being, quote-unquote, discriminatory in nature. And I think the other key point, as I made on our presentation about this, is that when OIG or the department is looking at those agreements, we're going to look not just at the covered entity as the responsible party. We're going to also look at the business associate to see if they've exerted, you know, market dominance in getting the covered entity or provider, in our case, to agree to terms where they're not sharing the information with certain providers. And that may be because they're not sharing with certain providers because that provider has a competitor's health IT, an EHR system. So we're going to look at the whole agreement in those circumstances, and both parties to that agreement could be subject to the information blocking provision. Moving on to the next slide. Before I move on real quick about the education piece, obviously we received a lot of comments about that. I guess, you know, and we've done our best, I think, in our rule to talk to, you know, and encourage providers to provide education about the privacy and security risks associated with sharing your information. I guess I'll say from my perspective is that, you know, there are many laws and many regulations out there. Our job was to implement a particular part of the law through our regulation using the authority we have. And so we think we've tried to do our best job with what we had in front of us and what we were asked to do by the law. But as we all know, there are a lot of laws and a lot of regulations because everything isn't addressed with, you know, one law and one regulation. So I'll just, that's my piece on that piece, saying my piece on that part of it, I should say. But again, we've given some options in the preamble, and I encourage you to look at that, of how you can implement an automated approach to providing your patients, I'm talking to providers now, your patients with information about the apps they're choosing to share or other entities they're choosing to share their EHI with. And that can include, you know, requiring it through an automated process and attestation for third-party apps to attest to certain privacy practices. We've in the final rule, have identified some what we think are minimum practices of third-party developers, privacy practices. And but you are free to, you know, have set an even higher standard from an attestation perspective and quote-unquote warn your patients as to whether or not the app they're choosing to share with meets such practices or adheres to such practices. All right, so now shifting. There are 8 exceptions, and I obviously cannot go through all those 8 exceptions with you now in great length, and I again will point you to the presentation we gave Monday. That should be available online soon, so you'll be able to look at it or listen to it at your leisure and review the slides. A few things just to mention, though, on some of them in terms of the comments provided by HITECH and just generally by commenters. Privacy exception. We got a lot of comments about, you know, the meaningful opportunity piece, and we believe we've addressed that accordingly with what we intended in the proposed rule, which is if there needs to be the whoever the entity coming asking for the information, they need to come with, you know, what looks to be a clear indication that the patient tried to give them consent or authorization, but maybe it's not perfected. So in that case, we want the provider to take reasonable steps to try to perfect that consent or authorization by providing the appropriate form, for example, to the patient, so they can provide the appropriate authorization or consent. It was not some commenters provided, it was not our intent to say that anybody can show up and say, I want, you know, all your, you know, from the recent accident, want all those patients' records, please go out and find them in your hospital somewhere and give them the opportunity to consent to providing that information to us. That was not our intent, and I think we've addressed that in the final rule. Infeasibility was another area where you guys, the high tech, had provided comment. We tried to provide a lot more specificity there, so you'll see two key ones. Essentially, what is, as an attorney, you know, we refer to as force majeure. So any type of uncontrollable act like a natural disaster, you know, those would be reasons not to provide information, you know, respond, so to speak, or fulfill a request for access exchange or use. And there are certain requirements that need to be met in doing so, including documenting why you're not doing it. But segmentation is also another one where you're unable to segment the record to you know, maybe there's certain privacy pieces that can't be segmented out in response to the request. So that's another one that you could use. And then looking at health IT performance, we got comments, you know, related to essentially when there's negative impacts on a health, on the, the system's performance. And so we've put in a provision now that allows for essentially like metering or throttling if there's a negative impact on the overall performance of the healthcare system. So that was, I believe, comments also provided by high tech as well as other commenters. So at this point, I think I want to jump in, and maybe it'll be on our next slide, and talk about, you know, it's quote-unquote a new exception, but it really finds its basis in the infeasibility exception, as well as the EHI definition and the comments we received on the EHI definition. So if you can just, I'm going to pause for a second and grab a drink here real quick. I'm still getting over the flu I got from my kids. Content and manner. So what this allows first and foremost is to allow the market to dictate the fulfilling of a request for access, exchange, and use. And it also, and so how does it do it? First, in the, and which is key, in the, after compliance is required, and so then the next 18 months time frame, the content, which is the EHI that we're talking about, is limited to that data that is identified in the USCDI. And so to be some clarity on that is that it isn't the USCDI itself with all its associated standards. It's just you have that data that's identified there. So that would include notes. If you have them in an electronic format, it would include problems if you had them only in ICD-10 and not SNOMEDS. So hopefully that provides additional clarity. But any data requested outside of the data identified in USCDI would not need to be provided in those first 18 months. So the manner, like I said, first out of the gate gives the opportunity for parties to reach agreement on that. So if there is a proprietary format in which the requester would like the data, the actor has the option to reach an agreement irrespective of both the fees exception and the licensee exception. And if they cannot reach agreement on those on terms with the requester, then there is a they have the ability to still qualify for this exception through an alternative manner. I think at this point we probably want to move to the next slide just so I can get that up on the screen. Okay, so that's the content. I had already talked to you about that. Now we can move to the next slide, which I believe would be, all right. So this kind of lays out the parameters like I was talking to you about. So you can move to the alternative manner if you're just not technically able to meet the request. But the, what I was talking to you more about was the ability to first meet market terms in providing the data. And if that can't be done, you move to the next slide, to the alternative manner so that we can move to the next slide now. Okay, so we've prioritized the way in which that information should be provided, still focusing on the requester. one key piece, though, and this goes, and I talked to you about delay earlier, it doesn't mean once you're inside the exception, you can delay as long as you want in providing the alternative manner. So from a consistency perspective, since you're required to respond generally without delay, same holds true when it comes to the alternative manner to get to be able to take advantage of this exception. And so the order of priorities are, you know, generally focusing on interoperability, which is also a key component of this rule. So you start with standards that have been certified, right? And it's not, if it's, so we talk in the preamble about both content and transport, but you don't have to have both. So if the requester says, I just want it in the CCDA, I know you have direct certified, doesn't mean you have to provide it to me in direct. I don't use direct, let's say. I just want it in the CCDA. That's permittable under the first priority. If you're moving into the second priority, it is again at the requester and again under the content and transport standards that they may request and you have available. If you can't do it technically in the way they do it or request it, then you eventually move down to three. And the overall goal here is to make sure that the EHI is getting out and is getting to the requester. So hopefully something is achieved through one of the other three ways, either through the market way, through the certified way, the standardized way. But if not, we still want the information to move. And then the actor is responsible to provide it in a machine-readable format, including ability to interpret that EHI as agreed upon by the requester. Example we provide in the rule is the EHI export could be one way of meeting this number three alternative option. And I think that wraps it up. Let me go check the next slide. Go next slide. Yes. Okay. So I don't know if we are entertaining questions, but I wanted to hit clearly abbreviated presentation, but I try to focus on some of the key policies and proposals that HITECH and others commenters had focused on in their comments, and then I think the key pieces we just generally from a policy perspective we wanted to emphasize. So thank you.
Thanks, Michael, for that great and really brief but very comprehensive overview of where things are at with the infoblocking. Given our situation with time and in consultation with Lauren Ritchie, we've decided to not take questions at this point and potentially to revisit this topic in April or at a future HITECH meeting if there's interest from the HITECH members. I think we can see pretty clearly today that there's a great deal to unpack in all of these presentations and aspects of the rule. And it may be to our benefit to be able to do that in more depth in future weeks as we have a greater chance to look at the rule. So with that, I'm going to transition to Beth Myers to take us through the Health IT for Pediatric Care and Practice Settings presentation. Go ahead.
Hey, thank you. So before we kick off, I actually don't have very many slides for this, but wanted to thank everyone on the HITECH and also on the Pediatric Care and Practice Settings Task Force that was convened last year to talk through our overarching approach for health IT for multiple types of care and practice settings and sort of understand how the work that's been going on specifically for pediatric care for health IT supports that's really been going on for the better part of a decade at this point in time. And it has involved partners from CMS, from AHRQ, from other parts of the department, as well as a wide range of public stakeholders, including a number of organizations representing different provider groups. We've had standards development organizations that have been engaged with us. We've had multiple health IT developers, both those who are working on pediatric specific products and those who are working on sort of broad universal products that need to be implemented in a wide range of spaces. So I wanted to take a moment and sort of thank that collective input into this process. We can go to the next slide. So what you will see if you look at the final rule is that within the scope of our rulemaking, we adopted an approach that essentially took the directives of the CURES Act, Section 4001 of the CURES Act, and also looked at what we could do that might sort of be beyond those very specific policies within that law that directed us to do, you know, adopt recommendations for the voluntary certification to support pediatric care and practice settings. So we described this a bit in our rule, but I also want to talk through it briefly and then give you a little bit of a teaser of some things that are up and coming that ONC is working on, again, with that collaborative effort across the whole industry, frankly, that folks have been involved and engaged in trying to really promote health IT solutions that are innovative and specifically capable of supporting the care of children, but also ensuring that as children transition from setting to setting, that the data that needs to be available for providing care to a child outside of a pediatric setting that is, you know, uniquely pediatric is also available in those other types of care settings. So what we started with within the rule is in the proposed rule, we outlined our 10 recommendations for the voluntary certification of health IT. Those 10 recommendations were based on clinical priorities that were identified through a collaborative process with the community, starting from things like the children's EHR format, going all the way back to 2013, I believe, was the original several hundred identified priorities that was narrowed down over time, and a prioritization process was applied to it to get to a list of 10. We convened stakeholders and met with them about what those 10 clinical priorities really mean and how to conceptualize the development of tools that can support those. Within the final rule, we laid out our approach to doing so, ensuring that health IT in the certification program can support those 10 clinical priorities. I do want to point out very clearly, because this was an ongoing question, that we have adopted we've developed these recommendations for certification of health IT for pediatric care under the existing program. This is not a separate program track. There is not a separate certification pathway that is just pediatric specific. The reason for that is we heard pretty loudly and clearly from commenters and from the high-tech task force that there should not, in fact, be a layered approach to certification. You don't want a provider who's giving pediatric care to have the technology that is stamped for pediatric and ambulatory and X-Bing and so forth to create this chain event of these separate and disparate certifications, but rather to have it unified within the overarching program. So that is the path that we did take. So that within the program, the criteria that we're looking at specifically can be broadly applicable to a wide range of settings and support those clinical priorities. So you'll see our 10 recommendations are reiterated within the final rule, and we identify some specific criteria that are particularly useful in addressing those 10 recommendations. They include things like the inclusion of the pediatric vital signs within the USCDI, the API itself, which is an essential tool for ensuring that the health data of pediatric patients can move from setting to setting. We know that children with complex care needs are seen in multiple settings by multiple different provider types, so ensuring that that care coordination has complete records is absolutely essential. And then we also included things like the voluntary certification criteria related to security tagging to be able to more easily apply security labels at a more granular level, which is a fairly constant need within a pediatric setting to be able to appropriately identify which data element or class might be restricted by a given law or statute within a state or jurisdiction. So the other thing that we did within the final rule is identified the current new 2015 edition criteria that support these practice settings based on those clinical priorities. So you'll see those laid out. I mentioned a few of them just now. But we also describe our ongoing non-regulatory initiatives that are attempting to sort of provide the next layer of support to this. We understand that the certification criteria are specifically a functionality or a standard that is this broadly applicable. We often use the analogy of the floor. So the certification program is setting the floor. We want to ensure that people who are doing pediatric care can effectively work with their developers or the developers who are creating product to support pediatric care settings are able to build the appropriate structure on top of that floor. So we've done some work with stakeholders, and if we can go to the next slide. These are previews of what we expect to be seeing in the next few months, some really exciting products coming out that sort of take the next step. And I do want to thank, there are those of you who I would say in the room, but it's virtual. So in the virtual room, who have supported and helped provide feedback onto an informational resource that we are currently developing to help sort of take that next layer. So looking at the certification criteria and how they specifically address the clinical priorities, but recognizing that in order to be most appropriate for pediatric care needs that might vary, for instance, a pediatric oncologist might have different needs than a pediatric care provider providing care for a teenager who is transitioning and needing to recognize the difference between those implementation specifications or those unique needs for different types of growth charts or whatever else those resources are, that kind of goes beyond what you can capture within the certification program. So we've been working with partners to do a couple of things. One of them is, it's not on there yet, but soon you will be seeing on our website, the Health IT for Pediatric Care and Practice Settings page, there will be an informational resource that is available for Health IT vendors and developers to see some of these resources and tools that have been developed through pilots, through other federal partners, through standards developing organizations that cover sort of the next phase or the next technical specification needed to more specifically address pediatric care needs in a variety of settings. And we've also worked with the technology team who's been heavily engaged in all of this effort at ONC to update our interoperability standards advisory to specifically identify with a form of tagging standards that are under review within the interoperability standards advisory for pediatric care. So those are two pieces of what we've done so far, but there is more coming. So we're very excited about this work, and we will keep all of you informed, including those of you who are obviously directly have been involved in providing us feedback on these resources as they're being developed. But we'll look forward to engaging again soon about the next steps when that next piece is published, which should be, we hope, this spring. So stay tuned for that. And I believe at this point, I can pass it off if we if the chairs do want to do questions or have further discussion, I'll go ahead and hand it back.
It looks like we are a few minutes ahead on public comment. And I know I can see that there were some questions published about the info blocking. So let's go two questions with Health IT Care Continuum, and then we'll take Stephen's questions related to info blocking and then go to public comment. Are there any questions for the Health IT Care Continuum? Okay, Aaron, I'm sorry.
Yeah, sorry, mine was on info blocking, so I'll just hold till then.
Aaron, Mary, did you have your hand up for a second? Okay, let's go to Stephen Lane, and then we'll go back to Arian.
Thank you so much. I appreciate the chance to ask for some clarification on information blocking. I have one question I'm going to raise, which is not one of the two that I put in the chat, because I think they could perhaps wait till later. We heard from both CMS and ONC that the info blocking requirements on providers to provide access to patients to all of the data in the US CDI are complex, and they kick in with different time frames depending on whether you're an HIT developer, whether you're a payer, whether you're fulfilling the requirements of the Promoting Interoperability Program, et cetera. But I just want some distinct clarification on one point. In my reading of the rules, providers are required to provide electronic access to the data elements in USCDI beginning 6 months after the final publication of the rule.
in a manner that is technically feasible, acceptable, et cetera. Does this mean that clinician notes, which are now included in US CDI version 1, must be provided electronically upon request to patients in the manner that they request, including access via the patient portal where that access exists and the technical capability exists, which is what some people have referred to as open notes?
I guess that's up for me. This is Mike Lipinski. I'm actually going to, before I answer your question, Stephen, I'm going to answer a question that wasn't, I guess, specifically asked. Well, it was maybe even by you, but I wanted to offer a piece of clarity that I forgot to do when I was giving my presentation. So while I talked about how we refocused the HIN definition, I want to be clear to everyone, it's still a functional definition. So there's no particular entities precluded from being able to meet the HIN definition. So a plan or a provider, if it does everything that we've listed there in the HIN definition, then they would be a HIN. So I want to make that clarity. But, you know, generally speaking, we haven't said, like the HIPAA statute and regulations do that say, like a clearinghouse is a covered entity, a health plan is a covered entity. We're not doing that, but I want you just to be aware that there's still a functional definition. So now back to your question. If it's notes are identified in the US CDI, there's, I think, 8 of them types. If a covered actor, an actor, which would be a healthcare provider, if they had them electronically available in an EHI format, and you know they can be provided through the patient portal or even through an API, then it's EHI. Now, there, you know, as I've showed in my presentation, there are reasons why that they may not provide it. Right? There could be an exception that they meet, but generally speaking, you know, they are an actor. They have what would be EHI. So then, you know, you go through the list, you know, in terms of whether or not they would be an information blocker and whether an exception could apply. But to your main point of asking, are notes in? Yes, after 6 months, if you have notes in electronic format, then they would be subject to the EHI definition.
And this is Elise, just to add, when I mentioned it earlier, I think I misspoke and said effective date, then I corrected it to publication date. Stephen, you said it correctly, it's the publication date, but I do want to highlight that it's 6 months from the publication date when the information that Mike just described would be required to be made available.
Mike, can you mention how this the content and manner applies there, though?
So there's a couple things there, right? You could, if you are a requester, you could reach agreement on costs and if there's a need for a license to get access to that EHI, including the notes. But maybe that's not even necessary, right? Like, or if you're the requester, you're not going to agree to the terms yourself. So you don't want to pay anything for it. So if they're technically able to, you would drop down to the alternative manner, which is a certified health IT. So a lot of the providers you were aware of have certified view, download, transmit functionality. So if they have the VDT functionality and they have the notes in electronic format, and that's how the requester is fine with getting them, then that should happen.
Thank you.
And then you would just proceed.
That's very helpful.
Hopefully that's it. All right. Great.
No, it's excellent. I may have time to slip in one more question for you, Mike.
I'm
sorry.
I
really appreciate it. No, I don't? Okay, I wrote them down.
We're going to Arian's question, and we will go to public comment.
Thank you. And I, Mike, I think this is going to be for you as well. But I have a hard time parsing the between and among standard for exchange and the enable to exchange with each other standard for HIE, HIN, and I guess the more than two are sort of the operative words. In figuring out what the dividing line is between an entity that is primarily engaged in doing work on behalf of one party to get information to another party that I'm understanding would not be an HIE, HIN, and an entity mm-hmm. that would be enabled to exchange more than one, to enable exchange that's between and among more than one party. And I wonder whether you've got if you can help sort of folks who are thinking about this parse through where the operative dividing line would be between an entity of one type that would not be considered HIE-HIN and an entity of the other type that would be considered an HIE-HIN.
So, Aaron, I probably even had a little trouble following you. Where were you coming with the between and among?
So between and among is in the definition of exchange. And the commentary in the preamble, as I read it, kind of looked at both of the definitions of the enable to exchange and then the definition of exchange as implying between and among. But right. just that notion of enable to exchange with each other. If you can just mm-hmm. help me understand what the I'm just trying to figure out what's an HIE, HIN, and what's not, just sort of conceptually, so then we can then figure out where the rule applies.
So, without specific, because, we were clear in the rule that we weren't going to specifically carve out certain entities. We did give a couple examples of ones we didn't think no longer would meet the definition, such as, like, I think it was a social networking or internet service providers,
yep.
I think was the example, off the top of my head.
We have some entities that are clearly on one side, and then I think there's some entities that are clearly on the other side, and I'm having a hard time kind of painting the line with the language of what's the operative definition, where that line gets painted, that allows me to clearly divide up entities on one side or the other of that line.
I don't know if there's, for us, it was the ability of, like, if you were thinking of it, if you had like a straight line and I was passing the data through, like, so we'll try to do a pictorial representation of this verbally. So if I was on one end and I was passing it through, which you quote unquote the entity that may or may not be the HIN, and then they're doing something with the data or maybe just providing the infrastructure for you to get the data to the other entity, whether it's a reporting agency or the government of some sort, that wouldn't be, even if there was like six nodes on or seven or hundreds on the one end, and there could be one or two on the other end, or even hundreds on the other end, that wouldn't matter. Like, so for clarity, it wouldn't matter how many nodes are on either end of this. Obviously, you need the three, so let's as a basis when we start to get to the HIN definition. But what is important is that entities on either side are able to exchange with each other. So if you had all those providers on one end and all they're doing is funneling their information through to one other entity, that would not be a HIN. But if they were able to exchange with each other through the services or the agreements of that entity in the middle, then that would be a HIN, as long as there was three of them, right? And it was for payment treatment operations and meets all the other parts of the definition. But right now, I think we're just trying to focus on who's exchanging, right? And or at least has the discretion to exchange. And then on the other end, it would be not necessarily they should be able to also exchange with the parties on the other end indiscriminately if they so chose. So it's really about providing the ability for everybody on the whatever you want to call it, either through the agreement or the technological services, to be able to exchange information with each other. They don't necessarily have to be doing it, but they have to have the discretion to be able to do it and be enabled to do it. I'm not sure if that's helping you, but
It may be Harry, it might be useful having Harry, a set of four instances or you know some FAQs in this area.
Okay, yeah.
That just would help by way of illustration. Really appreciate your clarification.
Yeah, Arian, it's Don Rucker here. Part of what we wanted to do here is not have folks who are essentially doing, for want of a better word, clearinghouse functions, who are not really, you know, distributing it in sort of a classic network sense, for them to not, you know, to not be covered under this concept. That's, and, you know, that's sort of a hard thing to define. So this was an effort to define it.
Understood. Thank you, and really appreciate that.
Yep.
Great. Thanks, everyone. I am going to open it up for public comment now. If the operator could please open the line and let us know if we have anyone in the queue.
Yes, thank you. If you would like to make a public comment, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. A confirmation tone will indicate your line is in the queue. You may press star 2 if you would like to remove your comment from the queue. For participants using speaker equipment, it may be necessary to pick up your handset before pressing the star keys. There is no one in the queue at this time.
Okay. Thank you, operator. Given that we are closing in on the end of our meeting, I will just give you a brief update on where things are at with the COVID-19 action by HITECH. We've had some discussion behind the scenes, and we are interested in going forward with some further action dedicated specifically to that. So we ask a couple of things. First, that you would send Robert and I any comments or questions or topics of interest that you have related to COVID-19 by the close of business or whatever time you wrap up your day on Friday. I will collate all of that and send all of that feedback out to the full HITECH membership. As with the annual report, we will be completely transparent about all of that. This is just the way that we can move forward in as quick a fashion as possible. I will be working with ONC with the goal of getting either a call or some kind of a task force thing set up for next week. In your response, please let us know if you favor a one-time call or you're thinking about something that continues for a longer period like a task force or a working group. We will do our best to get something set up for next week, and Robert and I will keep you in the loop about that. We do have some federal guidelines about the kinds of notice that have to be given, but we'll be looking into what we can do as expediently as possible. And with that, I will pass the mic to Robert for his final comments.
Carolyn, it looks like there are some public comments that are trying to come on, if you look in the chat.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think there is a public comment in the queue. Why don't we go ahead and, operator, we can take the public comments.
Thank you. Our first public comment is from Michael Peters with American College of Radiology. Please proceed.
Hi, this is Mike Peters from ACR. This is a question that hopefully you could respond to with a clarification. The enforcement discretion for info blocking will be exercised until OIG promulgates the enforcement rule. But where this is talked about in the rule is where it applies to CMPs for developers. What isn't clear is if this enforcement discretion also applies to investigation and implementation of the provider disincentives. Could someone please clarify?
Well, I mean, I can mention, or I guess clarify to you that there is no provider disincentives at this time. So to be compliant with the statute, the secretary must identify those disincentives through notice and comment rulemaking, and that has not occurred.
Okay, could we go on to the next comment in the queue, please?
Our next comment is from Kate Disroches with Open Notes. Please proceed.
So my first question I think was already answered, which was what disincentives are in place to ensure that providers, healthcare providers, are providing access to patients, specifically to their notes, given that we think that among all of the data elements that are in the new data elements that are required, notes are the thing that's going to be a stumbling block for a lot of providers. So I'm wondering what the plan is for clarifying what those disincentives are. So that's my first comment. Second, wondering if there are any plans to move beyond something like a simple attestation to ensure that notes are being rolled out within organizations in a way that's robust and actually leads to patients using the notes. We've learned over the years that simply flipping the switch within Epic or Cerner is not enough to ensure that patients know that the information is there and know that it's valuable for them to use it. So that's I'd urge you to think hard about developing measures that ensure that patients are actually able to use those notes in a way that's simple and easy for them. And the third is what I have looked through the rule, and I'm still a little bit confused about what will ONC's response be to complaints against providers that are submitted by individuals that are saying, well, my provider isn't making my clinical notes available to me. And I'm wondering what the response from ONC will be. I know that for vendors and tech developers, there's a financial disincentive, but I don't think I didn't see that there was anything in there for providers. So I'm wondering what ONC is thinking about that. Thank you.
Thank you for that. I think due to the interest of time, we'll probably move on. Stephen, I know that you have your hand up, but we won't have time to take another comment at this point. I apologize. I recognize that our schedule was way too packed for adequate time for discussion and questions. We always try to accommodate as much as we can, but in this particular case, we were not as successful as we have been. You've already heard Carolyn describe the plan that we have for the COVID-19. Please get your comments by email to us. We are trying to be as responsive as we can in this area. I hope you recognize it's a very dynamic situation. We have some federal guidelines that we have to pay attention to in doing this, and we'll work with you and the ONC to get this accomplished for you. Again, we always appreciate your time and attention and talent in our deliberations. We continue to ask for your commentary to us as your chairs to make this process better. But again, thank you for your patience and consideration. And with that, I'll turn it over to the ONC for their final comments.
Is Don still on? Does he have any final comments?
No, I'm on. I just want to thank folks. We'll look through some of the comments that were made online and try to figure out how to incorporate those. But thank everybody, and look forward to getting people's thoughts on the HIT parts of the virus strategy.
Okay, thank you. So our next meeting is April 15th, HITECH meeting. We also have a condition of certification and public certification maintenance public webinar on March 19th. The next ICAD meeting is on March 24th. And just a reminder to everybody, just go to healthit.gov for more information on upcoming meetings for the HITECH. So thanks, everybody. Carolyn?
I have nothing else. Thank you again for your participation today, and HITECH members, please send Robert and I your comments regarding the health IT part of COVID response by the end of the day Friday. We will collate that, get that out to you, and update you about next meeting, work group, or steps. Thank you.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.